Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Lewis Dartnell on how the Earth made us, in his new book, Origins. Lewis Dartnell is a professor of science communication at the University of Westminster. He has won several awards for his science writing and contributes to The Guardian, The Times and The New Scientist. He has also written for television and appeared on BBC Horizon, Sky News, Wonders of the Universe, Stargazing Live, and The Sky at Night. His previous books include the bestseller, The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch, which you may remember we talked about in a previous Little Atoms, and his latest book, Origins, How the Earth Made Us, we're going to talk about today. Lewis, welcome back to Little Atoms.
It looks like you've got a press release out in front of you and you just read the blurb. It's very nice of you to have done so, though. Thank you.
What's the idea behind Origins, first of all?
So, the general concept, that the kind of guiding principle behind the book, was to look at all the different ways that features of the Earth as a kind of a planet have influenced the human story. So everything from our literal origins, our evolution in East Africa, all the way to the very beginnings of agriculture and the very first civilizations and cities, through modern history and even up to, you know, kind of politics and elections in just the last couple of years. And all the different ways that the Earth has influenced and affected and directed that story, that narrative.
And in what way is this sort of a companion piece to The Knowledge?
So it is. It's not entirely clear. It doesn't kind of clamour that, really. But my last book, The Knowledge, it was a conceit. It was a thought experiment on how you could reboot civilization from scratch after some kind of hypothetical apocalypse. So in a sense, it was... It didn't have anything to do with doomsday and the world. It was just a way of peering behind the curtains of the modern world and asking just how stuff works, where it comes from, how things are made. So what were the important scientific discoveries and technological inventions that enabled us to go from 10,000 BC and huddling in caves to the modern world of antibiotics and electricity? So it was all about the kind of human invention and human ingenuity in making our world. And what I wanted to do for the new book, for Origins, was to kind of step back even further and look at history in the grandest possible terms and how the Earth has been involved in that story, how the planet we live in is almost like a character in the play alongside humanity as a species.
So let's go back to the evolution of our own species then. So, you know, the first sort of, you know, hominids that start to stand on 2 feet in the African Rift Valley. What is it about that particular part of the world that made it the correct environment, you know, the suitable environment for us to evolve? And also, you know, why was it geologically so special?
Well, so in the broadest brushstrokes, what needs to happen to turn, you know, kind of forest-dwelling, tree-swinging apes into bipedal, walking upright, intelligent, naked apes like humans was the whole region of East Africa dried out. And in general terms, it went from forest to grasslands, and a whole series of evolutionary adaptations in our kind of evolutionary line responded to that. But it was more than that. There was something specific and something quite weird that was going on in kind of planetary terms in East Africa in the last 5 million years or so that diverged us away from the chimpanzees and created such an eloquently talkative and intelligent, tool-using animal that is ourselves. And you've alluded to what it was already, and it's the Rift Valley. And what happened, there was a big plume of magma has been rising up beneath the plate of Africa, and it's kind of swollen up, it's kind of pushed up the crust in this big zit. And that's been largely what's been drying out East Africa, because East Africa lies in the same band of the earth as, you know, the rainforests of Indonesia and of the Amazon, so it ought to be very wet and tree forested. But the Rift Valley kind of tore open as this crack, this rift in the crust. And it was the interaction between the landscape of that Rift Valley. We have these high ridges of mountains on either side, but a very hot, low-lying valley floor that amplified the effects of little fluctuations, little variations in the Earth's climate as our orbit shifted slightly, or the kind of Earth's axis tilted in what are known as Milankovitch cycles. And the availability of water in that valley floor, particularly around these what are known as amplifier lakes, fluctuated severely. It was a huge effect from a very small, subtle influence. And it's that that's thought to have driven intelligence and smartness in our hominin lineage, that then we went on to make kind of tools and invent conversation.
I just wanted you to just mention the Milankovitch cycle, yeah. But also what's going on with the Earth is, as you said, you know, it's sort of orbiting the sun at different angles and stuff. And there's various cycles of ice ages. The Earth has an ice age, then it thaws, you know, there's a warmer period.
Yeah.
There's another ice age. What effect is that having?
Yeah, so the ice ages predominantly affect the high latitudes, so the very north, so, you know, across Siberia, North America, Europe, or the very south around the kind of, Chile land sits in South America today. So that's in the high latitudes, the bits near the poles during the ice age, they get very cold, they get very icy, that kind of makes sense. But around the tropics, around the equator, these Milankovitch cycles don't cause iciness because you're still warm, relatively, but it does have a profound effect on the availability of water. And that's why those Milankovitch cycles are important for our evolution. But they're also, these same cosmic cycles were instrumental in the next chapter, both of the human story and literally of Origins, the book, which was, okay, fine, we were crafted as this intelligent species in East Africa, but nowadays we're one of the most widely spread animal species on the planet. And that happened about 70,000 years ago, where we just kind of upped and left. We migrated. We dispersed out of East Africa, across Eurasia, up into Europe, around into the Americas. And what enabled us to do that was, as you say, the ice ages. Every time the Earth kind of slides into one of these glacial periods, these, you know, kilometres thick sheets of ice form over the northern regions, and that sucks up a lot of water out of the seas, the sea levels drop, and these land bridges get exposed. That you can literally walk from Eurasia, from the kind of far eastern side of Eurasia, right across the Bering Land Bridge into the Americas. Now, what was special about us, about Homo sapiens, is that previous hominin species, previous human species, did migrate all the way across Eurasia. So Homo erectus got as far as kind of China. But we were the only human species to ever have made it to the Americas. When Homo sapiens dispersed slowly across the Bering Land Bridge and walked into Americas, we were the first hominin species to tread in the Americas. And then we became this kind of global, world-spanning species in that process.
And obviously, you just mentioned that, you know, Homo erectus got all the way to China, and then, for whatever reason, died out. But also, like, you know, Neanderthals,
yeah,
the Denisovan,
yeah,
hominids also basically had these. So why was the later wave more successful?
It is a really good question. It's something that a lot of paleontologists and anthropologists are trying to kind of figure out. Why is it that, why are we a lonely species? Why are we the only hominins to survive, to have made it into the modern world? And importantly, why were we able to outcompete the Denisovans or the Neanderthals? Because Neanderthals, they were like burly, bulky hominins. They were physically stronger than us, and yet we seem to have been able to outcompete them. And it seems to be the case that we beat them with our brains, not with brawn. And we were probably better able to adapt to the changing conditions within the height of the Ice Age in Europe, when Neanderthals were focused, and we kind of inherited the Earth from them. And what was probably the reason for that is that we had spent longer in that fluctuating, unstable environment of East Africa than Neanderthals who'd left earlier. So it was almost like we had more training at becoming adaptable and versatile. And therefore, when we moved from the warm environment, warm and dry environment of Africa to the cold environment of Ice Age Europe, we're able to, you know, kind of use those transferable skills. I sound like a middle management guy now. We're able to use, as a species, we're able to use those transferable skills to kind of outcompete the Neanderthals and take over the world.
But this wasn't, I mean, this sort of migration of the species out of Africa, they didn't, you know, stick a flag in a map and say, you know, we'll go, it's getting crowded here, let's go somewhere else where there's probably land. This is like a very gradual,
yeah, exactly, widening, so it, out. It's not like there was this front, this packed line of Homo sapiens kind of furrowing their brow as they leaned towards the horizon and strove out for new lands. But it was the case that they were essentially feeling, oh, it's a bit crowded here, let's move on. So this was a dispersal, and, you know, we were still hunter-gatherers back there, so we were hunting whatever antelope species or ungulate species were in the local environment. And when our population started booming, people would kind of move a bit away from the edges and kind of colonise new lands and disperse in these very slow-moving waves. So it took tens of thousands of years to colonise the world, but it was the Ice Age, the most recent Ice Age, that enabled us to do that.
You alluded to this a little bit. The Ice Ages are also having, they're obviously having an effect on the climate, of course, if you live in Greenland or whatever. But as you mentioned, in Africa as well, the fact that, you know, a lot of the ocean waters are being, you know, transferred into ice, it affects things like ocean currents and things. Yeah. It affects the, you know, water in the atmosphere as well. So it has a distinct climatic change.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Ice Ages are, I guess, the most obvious, most conspicuous ramification of these Milankovitch cycles. But there are fluctuations in Earth's climate over not just recorded history, but over the longer history of civilization. And the Sahara Desert used to be green, used to be grasslands. There's cave paintings in what is now wind-blown sand, rock paintings that clearly depict like crocodiles and gazelle. And so the Sahara dried out, it was green and it became hyper-arid like it is today. And one idea as to what might have been the main factor for driving the emergence of civilization in ancient Egypt, i.e. along the Nile Valley, was essentially climate refugees getting out of the Saharan region as it dried out, and that driving up kind of population density and forcing people to become a bit more intensive of their agriculture and living together in villages and in towns than the kind of early cities. So it was probably a climate shift driven by these Milankovitch cycles that caused us to civilize as a peoples.
And moving on a bit to when we do start to, you know, develop agriculture and particularly to start to settle down in cities, this starts to happen particularly along an area called the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia. And that, again, sort of geographically is in a particularly like unique environment.
Yes, there's, I redrew this map. So all of the figures, all of the pictures in Origins are mostly kind of maps and kind of cartography that I've done myself. I spent far too long, let's be honest, working out, learning how to use the software to create my own maps with the different data sets that I wanted to show. And one of the maps I show is a map of the world with the boundaries between the tectonic plates. So basically these cracks in Earth's crust, these fractures, and this really strong correlation just leaps out of you when you look at that map and show the points of origin of some of the earliest civilizations around the world. And they are all clustered along these plate boundaries. And so the question is, plate boundaries are like rubbish places to be. That's where the volcanoes are. That's where the volcano and earthquakes shake. So why would the early civilizations have been kind of attracted there, as it were? One of the answers is clearest when you look at Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, between the Tigris and Euphrates. And that entire region is very full of lovely, fertile, silty soil. It's alluvial soil. It's all deposited by those rivers that's been eroded out by the mountains to the north. And what created that region of Mesopotamia is the block of Arabia is on its own plate, its own tectonic plate. And it's been essentially swinging away, pivoting away from Africa. And recently, in geological terms, recently slammed into the bottom half of Eurasia to crumple up the Zagros mountain ranges. And so when you've got this great big, heavy mountain range, the kind of crust, the ground alongside it sags down a bit. And so that's where the river flows, that's where the silt and sediment gets deposited. And that's what makes this lovely, rich region that makes agriculture easy. So Mesopotamia is a tectonic trough. And then humans first settled down there in the origins of cities. And also in the Indus Valley, which is basically exactly the same setting, but in the feet of the Himalayas mountain.
I want to carry on talking about early agriculture, but before we do, just a couple of other things that occurred when the ice was melting from the sort of last great ice age. And particularly, I wanted to talk about the land bridge that basically occurred between that existed between the UK and the English Channel, basically the UK and France, and what happened there.
Yeah, so there's what I've tried to do throughout Origins is weave together these kind of threads of science and geology and earth sciences with history and what happened in the human story and why. And one of the main stories, well, clearly for us because we're living in Britain, but for European history as a whole, is that you have continental Europe, but then this island of Britain, which has been important through history because in many periods of European history, it's been this island fortress which has stopped anyone consolidating an empire across Europe. So Hitler was unable to invade Britain and kind of win the war in Europe. Before that, it was the Spanish. Before that, it was the, kind of the French. And so the question is, why was Britain an island then? Because looking at the geology, we used to be linked, like kind of Siamese twins, like co-joined twins to Europe by what's known as the Weald-Artois anticline. So the White Cliffs of Dover are basically the stump left behind when this great big bridge of rock was eroded away, was washed away in a catastrophic mega flood. So some of the words I just love when I was coming across and researching the origins, and mega flood was one of my favourites. And this great big huge flood of water very rapidly eroded away that block of rock that was connecting us to Europe. And what had happened is that during an ice age, not the most recent ice age, but in fact one about four or five ice age cycles ago, it's about 500,000 years in the past, two great sheets of ice met each other over what is now the North Sea and trapped this great big lake of meltwater, which kind of burst its banks essentially, and this entire thing emptied in the blink of an eye and then eroded away the Dover Straits. So it's the ice age and one of the effects of the ice age that's created Britain as an island, and therefore that rich interplay throughout European history of Britain as an island and the rest of continental Europe.
And we know that because of the bottom of that Dover
Strait. So there's I mean you can go to the bibliography of Origins and look up the paper that I've cited and look it up on Google Scholar, and there's been some beautiful papers in the last couple of years where they've taken sonar equipment out on boats and got these incredibly high resolution pictures of what the seafloor looks like in the English Channel, or La Manche as the French would call it, and like clear as day there are these great big valleys gouged out in the rock by this mega flood. There are the plunge pools by these enormous waterfalls that would have been plunging over the land bridges as it was first eroding. And these kind of islands that have been eroded into almost kind of streamlined shapes, vast islands eroded in streamlined shapes by that mega flood. So since the last ice ages has thawed, the sea levels have risen again, and it's now a drowned landscape. It's now underwater. But you can really clearly see where that mega flood had caused to create us as an island.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Lewis Dartnell, and we're talking about his latest book, Origins, How the Earth Made Us. And Lewis, I said I wanted to go back to agriculture, and right across the world, almost, you know, simultaneously, and you know, as far as simultaneously works in geological time or in history, and people started to, you know, settle down and start to grow crops. And obviously, you know, in the Far East it was rice, and in, you know, Mesoamerica it was corn. But in Eurasia, around that, you know, Fertile Crescent, the list of crops is endless. Again, you know, what was it, what was unique about that area that meant there were, you know, there were so many grasses that were basically developed into...
So I think that in itself is something that's worth kind of lingering on for just a second, that all of humanity, through all of our history and all the kind of history of civilizations, we basically fed ourselves on three main crops, three staples: the maize in the Americas, wheat across Eurasia, and rice in the kind of further east. And all of those staple crops, all of those cereals, are species of grass. So you, me, everyone else alive today, everyone throughout history, has basically fed themselves on grass in just the same way that the sheep or goats or cows that we keep out in pasture do. And the reason that we have chosen to eat grass, the reason we domesticated those wild species, is ecologically, grass species, they kind of live fast and die young. They grow quickly. They dump all of the energy they can absorb out of the sunlight into their grain, which are botanically fruit. They put all that energy into these little dollops of grain, which is the rice or the sweet corn, which then is very easy for us to harvest and kind of store and then come back to eat later. So we've kind of hacked the biological reproduction mechanism of grass species to feed ourselves, and then found all these civilizations through history. And one of the main distinctions between people living in Eurasia and people living in the Americas, which then had huge knock-on effects throughout history, was that just through chance, Eurasia seems to have had a wider range of cereal crops, of these grass species that could have been domesticated, compared to the Americas. And also that Eurasia is largely an east-west continent. So it's easy to move things across the same line of latitude without encountering different climates. So rice can be spread, wheat can be spread across Eurasia. Whereas in the Americas, moving maize or other crops north or south along the kind of vertical orientation of the Americas was much harder. And Jared Diamond has pointed this out in his cracking book, Gun Germ Steel. That simple fact, just about the orientation of the continents when the supercontinent of Pangaea broke apart, has had huge implications through the passage of history.
I wanted to talk about, you talk in the book about the domestication of animals, and, you know, obviously from the hunter-gatherers started to tame, you know, live alongside dogs, and two, obviously, you know, the animals that we both, you know, domesticate for food, for meat, but also for, you know, milk and wool and things. But I wanted to talk about particularly about human beings' gradual effect as we spread out on, again, another great word, the megafauna.
it is another good. It's all the mega words. Yeah, so we mentioned already about how it was the last ice age and the lower sea levels that enabled us to spread around the world and particularly colonise into Australia and the Americas. And looking at the fossils, looking at the story that's been kind of kept in the rocks, in most cases, as soon as humans rocked up, turned up, the megafauna just disappeared. They died out. And what we think had happened is that humans had just got very, very good at hunting in Africa as hunter-gatherers and then spreading out. And so when the megafauna, so kind of large species that had previously had no natural predators, when we turned up with stone tools and spears, the megafauna just kind of didn't know what to do. They had no survival strategy, no evolutionary reason to fear humans, and we essentially hunted them into extinction. So in a sense, this was an early warning of kind of the human dominion, that we wiped out all of megafauna to eat, and we've now developed more and more sophisticated tools, more and more sophisticated technologies, and we're now marshalling the kind of energy resources and natural resources of the planet to such an extent that we're changing the environment of the whole world. People are familiar with global warming and things like that, but that whole process started, you know, thousands of years ago as we were first colonising the world and hunting stuff to extinction.
I want to talk about the Himalayas, and I think most people know how relatively young the Himalayas as a range is, and this is caused by, you know, what is now India crashing into... Yeah. Crashing again is not quite strictly the right word, but, you know, very, 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 very slowly.
Slow motion crash. Crashing. Like that bit in Austin Powers with the steamroller.
Into the sort of supercontinent and basically pushing up that mountain range. And that has an effect, obviously, climatically, you know, monsoons and things. And, you know, and obviously linked to that as well is how vital that Tibetan plateau is basically to water, to just, you know, the water supply of that entire continent.
Yeah, so it's I guess quite a big question because it has lots of things that link into each other. And that was the main thing I was trying to get across with Origins, was all these deep connections lying beneath the surface that link what you would have thought would be kind of completely unrelated topics and in history and in the modern world. And in fact, the working title for the book when I was writing it was Deep Connections. And one of the interesting points there was, today, with kind of modern geopolitics, why is it that China cares so much about Tibet? And, you know, there's the whole kind of human rights questions, there's the Dalai Lama living in exile, but there's a very, very simple reason coming down to the kind of landscape of the earth as to why China cares about Tibet. And it's because the Tibetan Plateau, this very high region of land associated with the Himalayas and then the crumpling of India into Eurasia, is referred to as the third pole of the planet. That there's a lot of ice on the north and south poles. There's a great deal of ice on the Tibetan plateau as well. And that melts and feeds 10 of the largest rivers around the world. So in a sense, China cares about Tibet because it cares about control of water. And particularly in a world with climate change, when, you know, rainfall patterns are going to start shifting and agriculture will become a bit less certain, you want to be able to control those fundamental factors that support your cities and be able to grow food for yourself.
I want to talk about the Mediterranean, and you describe it in the book as being, you know, particularly tectonically interesting as a place. And actually, just, you know, looking at a lot of the maps that you've drawn, whether it's like, you know, the continental drift maps or maps showing like the extent of, you know, the lower sea level stuff, the Mediterranean always seems to be roughly the Mediterranean as we know it now. Yeah. What's so special about that area?
So the Mediterranean, interestingly, is essentially just a puddle, a mere puddle left over from what was once a vast ocean called the Tethys. And since the breakup of the last supercontinent, Pangaea, and then the kind of reshuffling of the continents, the Tethys has steadily shrunken and disappeared as Africa kind of raced forward up into Eurasia again. And the Mediterranean is basically all that's left of this once vast ocean now. And the Mediterranean has been the kind of crucible, the cauldron for a huge number of cultures through history, of the kind of Greeks and the Romans and the Minoans and all these different cultures that we learn about in ancient history. But curiously, most of those cultures had all operated, they're all active on the northern coastlines of the Mediterranean. And if you just look at an atlas, just load up Google Earth now and look at the Mediterranean, it's this roughly kind of oval-shaped sea, and it's incredibly intricate and detailed along the northern coastlines, particularly around kind of the Greece and the Aegean. Whereas the African coastline, the southern coastline, the southern lip of the Mediterranean is kind of just a bit boring in comparison. So there's clearly a link between those two things, that the activity of cultures and civilizations was dependent on having natural harbors and inlets, because maritime activity is a very easy way of trading and moving things around. Whereas the North African coast is plain and doesn't have many harbours for civilizations to rely upon. And what's created that distinction is that tectonic reality that is Africa moving north and being subducted beneath Eurasia. So the northern Mediterranean coast is this kind of submerged, drowned landscape of valleys that give you great harbours and inlets. Whereas the northern African coastline is being kind of pushed down. It's just kind of straight and flat. So I love that. It's this really deep connection between a continental collision and plate tectonics that's created a difference in landscapes in two very nearby regions, which had a huge effect on us, on our civilizations and in our cities.
And of course, to link that back to something you mentioned in the first half, the north side of the Mediterranean is where there are still volcanoes.
Yeah, exactly. That's where, you know, Mount Etna and all the other active volcanoes in Europe are today, is around that northern coastline of the Mediterranean. And that's basically the top bit of Africa that's melted deep in the interior of the earth, bubbled back up to the surface and kind of burped out as molten rock, as the magma of a volcanic eruption.
So that's the ideal place for those early civilizations, you know, be it the Minoans or the, you know, Romans or whatever. But it's also like those civilizations that bore the brunt of, you know, like Pompeii or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So that continental collision is also what made available a lot of vital natural resources such as copper, and particularly for the Bronze Age. Mm-hmm. If you want to make bronze for simple tools and swords, you need copper and tin. And copper is produced by kind of hydrothermal vents on the seafloor, and then that's where it gets concentrated. So it was that continental collision and the disappearance of this Tethys Ocean that we mentioned earlier that made copper available for Bronze Age civilizations like the Minoans in Mediterranean.
Just one other thing before we finish, and I just wanted to talk about the importance of wind.
Yeah.
So we mentioned again in the first part that, you know, the changing climate obviously has an effect. The different raising of the sea levels has an effect on things like, you know, the Gulf Stream and sort of ocean currents as well. And again, part of that is, you know, weather systems that go all the way around the earth. Mm. And tell us something about how that basically, enabled global trade.
Yeah, so my favourite chapter from the whole of the book when I was researching and writing it was this one, about that deep link between something as fundamental as the circulation patterns in Earth's atmosphere to how that creates these alternating bands of prevailing winds around the world, and to the trade winds or the westerlies, and then how that, again, over hundreds of years, dictated the patterns of exploration and trade, and then ultimately European empire building and the beginnings of globalization, and then the modern world that grew out of that. That all comes down just the way that the atmosphere happens to turn over, because the equator is warmer than the poles, and the fact that the Earth is spinning, so you get Coriolis forces that kind of bend those winds in particular directions. And when the European sailors were first kind of reaching out into the Atlantic, with the Portuguese and Spanish, and then later the French, Dutch and British, they're essentially piecing together these little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle of Earth's winds, working out, where do I need to go to so the wind will blow in the direction I want to go to reach what I've now discovered is America? Or how can I get round the southern tip of Africa to reach India and all the spices that I want to kind of get involved in that trade, because a lot of money to be made in there? So it was this deep link between that just the atmosphere of the Earth and the wind patterns and the shape of the world today. Like, why is California so important and economically rich today? It's because that's where you reach in a galleon if you leave China and try to cross the Pacific. You know, that's hundreds of years of history in that simple fact.
So I've been talking to Lewis Dartnell. We've been talking about his new book, Origins, How the Earth Made Us, which is out now in the UK from Bodley Head. Lewis, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.